Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablot, professors of government at Harvard University and co-authors of How Democracies Die. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. America's constitutional system of checks and balances has endured for more than two centuries. This is due in part to two unwritten political norms, respectful tolerance between opposing parties and a measure of restraint by those in power. Yet, at contentious times in our history, those guardrails of democracy have been put to the test. In How Democracies Die, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablot covered decades of research on the breakdown in democracies in Europe and Latin America, looking at examples of creeping authoritarianism in places like Peru, Chile, Russia, and our occasional departure from democratic norms here in the United States. Levitsky and Zablot seek to answer a fundamental question plaguing today's political scientist. Is American democracy in danger? A political scientist and professor of government at Harvard University, Stephen Levitsky's research focuses on Latin America and the developing world, party systems and authoritarianism. A fellow professor at Harvard, Daniel Zablot, studies European politics and democratization and co-chairs the Challenges to Democracy Research Project with Stephen Levitsky. Both are frequent contributors to Vox and the New York Times. Stephen and Daniel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's get right into this. Democracy's dying. I mean, democracies can die from revolt. They can die from violent coups, but that's not exactly what you guys are getting at here. Explain yourselves as the title of this book.
Well, the way that democracies die has changed over time. During the Cold War, during most of the 20th century, far and away, the leading form of democratic death was the sort of classic military coup, the generals seizing power. It was very cut and dry, very easy to observe. But that has changed considerably since the end of the Cold War. Since 1990, over the last 25 years or so, the leading way in which democracies die is at the hands of elected leaders themselves, leaders, prime ministers, elected presidents, who use the very institutions of democracy to subvert it, to undermine it, often slowly, gradually, subtly, and in ways that citizens aren't always fully aware of.
So, Steve and Daniel, could you give our listeners just a general idea of your own research background? Steve, you in Latin America, if you could give us two or three examples of what you're talking about. I mentioned the countries, but what has happened there that presages what could happen here in America. And for you, Daniel, your work in Europe, Poland and Hungary come to mind. I just came back from Gdansk and Tallinn, Estonia, and boy, did I hear a mouthful from those folks about Putin and about their president in Poland and people who are objecting to the president's attempts to take over quite a bit of the government beyond constitutional control.
So you asked what we work on. This is Steve. I spent my career working on studying Latin American democracies, those that succeed, those that fail, but particularly ones that are troubled, that break down. And there were two cases in Latin America that we drew a lot from in writing our book. One is Chile, which was one of Latin America's strongest democracies for much of the 20th century. Very strong democratic institutions, pretty strong democratic norms, but which was really ripped apart in the 1960s and early 1970s by intense polarization. And so it offers some lessons about what can happen to even a very strong democracy when two parties go so far apart that they begin to view one another as enemies. The other case that we draw heavily from Latin America is Venezuela, more recently under Hugo Chavez, which is a case of exactly what I was talking about before, an elected leader, a freely elected president, who over the course of more than a decade packed the courts, began to use legislation and a bunch of other mechanisms to skew the playing field against the opposition, such that the regime gradually became increasingly authoritarian, really without most Venezuelans even being aware of it. There was a survey done in Venezuela in 2011, 12 years after Chavez took power, that found that most Venezuelans still believed they were living under a democracy. And we think that that kind of path even though we're not saying that American democracy is dead or even dying, we're simply saying that there are some warning signs that we have to not take the stability and the success of American democracy for granted. And if there's a case, sort of a case to look at for what could go wrong, Venezuela is one of them.
Daniel, what about Eastern Europe?
Yeah, so in our book and in my own research, I both focused on historical cases going back to the 1920s and 1930s, Germany, Italy. These were dramatic cases of democratic breakdown as well as contemporary cases. So maybe just a word on those historical cases, because there's actually something you can learn from those historical cases. So if you think of the breakdown of democracy in the 1920s and 30s in Europe, I mean, these were relatively new democracies founded after World War I, but there is a real lesson we can draw from those cases, which is that in both Italy and in Germany, authoritarians came to power through elections, in fact. And so you had outside demagogues in both Italy and in Germany who were real outsiders of the political system. So then the question is, how did they get into power? And the way they got into power was often with the aid of establishment politicians. So in Italy in the early 1920s, Mussolini was on the rise and he was an outsider. And a liberal Italian statesman, Giovanni Giletti, decided that he would try to tap into some of Mussolini's appeal and include him on a party list, and legitimated Mussolini in the process. And within a couple of years, Mussolini was in power and Giletti was long gone. A similar thing happened in Germany in the late 1920s, early 1930s. The traditional conservative party had a weak kind of electoral base, and it saw the popularity of Hitler on the far right and tried to form joint coalitions with them or joint party programs, held rallies, legitimating Hitler. And throughout, the elder statesmen of Germany thought, well, we can outmaneuver this guy. He's an outsider. So eventually they appointed him chancellor, again thinking they would use them to push their agenda. But at the end of the day, they were used by the outsider. So this is something that resonates throughout time. And I think in many ways, when we look at contemporary politics, both in the United States as well as in Eastern Europe, where you have people who are outsiders of the political system, often not committed to democratic norms, the insiders think they can use them. Just to come back to the cases you mentioned of contemporary, so more proximate to our own time, both in Hungary and in Poland. I mean, these were relatively new democracies that founded after the collapse of communism. Many people thought, since they're right on the edge of Western Europe, they were very quickly made members of the European Union, members of NATO, cooperate with the United States, that these were very promising cases of democracy. And in fact, democracy was established in these countries beginning in the 1990s. Really starting in Hungary with the rise of Viktor Orban, you had somebody, again, who was elected, who has democratic credentials in that sense, compete in elections, beat their political rivals in elections. But the critical question is, what do they do once in power? Because although they were democratically elected, somebody like Viktor Orban, what he did once in power is he began to go after the institutions of the state. He introduced a retirement age for judges, thereby forcing the instant retirement of a bunch of judges, allowing him to appoint a bunch of his judges to stack the court. With a supermajority, he altered the electoral rules to make it harder to vote him out and his party out of office. Started kind of pushing the media around, the free media around. And so in many ways, although, you know, Orban continues to be elected and was reelected recently, the playing field's been tilted to such a degree that many experts now agree that Hungary is no longer a democracy. And that at best, a kind of democracy with a question mark next to it. Similar trends have unfolded in Poland as well, where the government has really pushed to try to entrench itself in power by going after the neutrality of the courts, neutrality of media institutions. And so the more general lessons I would just draw from all of these European experiences, again, as Steve said, the U.S. is in a very different situation because there's much older institutions and much more robust institutions, but there's two similar parallels. One, the outsiders who threaten democracy often get into power through the aid of insiders. And second of all, even if somebody's elected with democratic credentials, once they're in office, they can try to entrench themselves to make an uneven playing field, and this threatens the basic legitimacy and the kind of quality of democracy.
So I guess the question is, what do citizens look for in their own government to assure that we're not going down one of these paths you've identified either in Latin America or Europe? And for that, you guys turn to the work of Juan Linz. I think he was a Yale professor. Maybe he still is, but a few years ago he did a litmus test, so to speak. Tell us about the litmus test. What can we do to identify undemocratic regimes?
Sure. Juan Linz was, unfortunately, has passed away. He was a Spanish political scientist who was born in Weimar, Germany, and grew up in Spain during the period of the Civil War. So he had lived as a young man the costs of losing a democracy. And he spent a good part of his career devoted to studying and learning how democracies die. And he wrote a widely read book in the 1970s called The Breakdown of Democratic Regimes, in which he put forth what he called a litmus test to identify authoritarian behavior. And Linz was maybe not the clearest writer in the world, so we sort of took his litmus test and cleaned it up and brought it into the 21st century a bit and presented a version of that in our book. I should be clear that there's no fail-safe way, there's no perfect way of identifying an authoritarian before they come to office. But if, as we said earlier, the way that democracies die today is at the hands of elected leaders, not generals seizing power, then it's really important that we pay attention to who we elect, right? If elected leaders are the modern assassins of democracy, we as citizens have to pay a lot of attention to the character, the qualities of the leaders that we elect. And what this litmus test does is offer some indicators, some warning signs that if you see this kind of behavior out of a candidate, that's a sign that maybe this isn't somebody you want in the White House or you want in power. And the four basic indicators, the four basic elements of the litmus test are a rejection of democratic rules, refusing to play by democratic rules, one. Two, threatening to withdraw or violate the civil liberties of opponents, including the media. Third is refusal to recognize the legitimacy of one's rivals. And fourth is condoning or promoting violence of any kind. And so if you see those behaviors in a candidate, our recommendation is don't elect him or her.
Gee, I can't imagine where I've seen that lately. So when it comes to the guardrails of democracy, what protects us from moving down this path, you talk about two in particular, forbearance and mutual toleration. Could you explain those?
Yes. Yeah, so sometimes, although an elected leader might violate the litmus test, voters vote for these guys and they get into office. And then we're in a situation where, you know, how can the damage be limited? And we tend to think, especially in the United States, that our Constitution is an incredibly robust document that includes some checks and balances that limit the potential damage of somebody who, even if not outright authoritarian, has ambitious kind of tendency. I mean, if you think of Franklin Roosevelt, you think of Andrew Jackson, you think of Richard Nixon, presidents who want to seek power, and the checks and balances are supposed to constrain these figures. So the thing, though, is that the Constitution itself is actually a very short document, the American Constitution. And although it's a brilliantly written document in many respects, it doesn't spell out all sorts of scenarios. And so it turns out, you know, according to the Constitution, the president, just to give you an example, can pardon whoever he or she likes at any point for any reason. The Senate, you know, has the right of advising consent, but they could, according to the law, block any nomination of a president at any point. And so politicians following the letter of the law could really bring our system of checks and balances into a kind of incredible level of dysfunction and even outright, you know, authoritarianism, if depending on how things unfold. So it's really critical, in fact, that we not only rely on the words that are on the page in the Constitution, but a set of unwritten rules. And the two unwritten rules that have been very predominant in the 20th century in the United States are these norms of mutual toleration, by which we mean politicians in the United States have historically tended to treat their rivals as rivals and not as enemies. They may disagree, they may even dislike their rivals, but they regard their rivals and say so publicly that their rivals for office have a right to compete for office in the government. So that's the first norm, the norm of mutual toleration. The second unwritten rule of politics in the 20th century that's reinforced our Constitution and made our system of checks and balances work is the norm of what we call institutional forbearance. And this is kind of a more unusual one, but basically what the idea is that politicians use an incredible degree of self-restraint. Our system requires incredible self-restraint, that politicians don't push to the max, that they may have certain constitutional powers and authorities, but at certain points in our politics, they need to step back from the brink. So again, although a president may have the right to pardon whoever he or she likes, presidents don't use this. They use this power with forbearance. You know, through most of our history, presidents actually, there was no limits on re-election. Presidents could have served more than two terms. Not until 1950s, after Roosevelt, did we have a limit on the president's ability to run for re-election more than two terms. But no president ever even tried to do this because of this norm of forbearance. And so what we've noticed in our own politics in the last 25 years is these two norms, which are so critical for the viability and functionality of our system of checks and balances, have begun to erode. And that's what really worries us.
And you have a chapter in your book about this erosion called the unraveling. And obviously the polarization that now characterizes our nation's politics did not happen overnight, and it did not begin with Trump, although it has certainly worsened since the 2016 election. But in this chapter of your book called The Unraveling, you take us back to the 1990s, and I wonder if you could just give us a capsule summary of what was going on. Newt Gingrich comes to mind. It really set us on this course, this divisiveness that seems to characterize politics today.
Yeah, I wouldn't blame poor Newt Gingrich for all of this. I think he was one of the first Republican politicians to kind of sense the changing winds and kind of sense that a more radical, disruptive, norm-violating strategy could succeed. I think he sensed that Americans were polarizing and that Republicans at the base level in particular were polarizing. And he was one of the first guys out there to push a new strategy. So a couple of things that Gingrich did. First of all, he very actively coached his fellow Republicans in the House to use language that we would consider mutual intolerance. He coached his Republican allies to use terms to describe Democrats like anti-flag, disloyal, treason, anti-family. That's the sort of language that suggests not accepting the legitimacy of your rival. And the other thing that Gingrich was really a master of what we call constitutional hardball, using the letter of the law in ways that sort of weaponize political institutions and undermine the spirit of the law. So he sort of invented the modern government shutdown in the mid-1990s. And although it wasn't driven by him, his allies were the ones who orchestrated the United States' first impeachment process in 130 years. What was at least in our view, partisan impeachment based basically on a technicality. So that sort of set the precedent for early constitutional hardball.
And when it comes to norm breaking, I don't think we have to go all the way back to Gingrich to see how this has grown in recent years. You mentioned two things, and I'd like for you guys to touch on these. The redistricting plan in Texas and voter ID laws. I don't know whether that was North Carolina. I think North Carolina has gotten into some of this, and you guys give some treatment of North Carolina later in your book. Help us there.
Sure. Well, the Texas redistricting, this is 2003. This is sort of another step along the way of escalating constitutional hardball. It was really the brainchild of Tom DeLay, who's another Republican. This was not just Republicans doing this, but Republicans were, in our view, sort of the first movers. The norm is we always redistrict in every state because of population changes. And the norm is to do it every 10 years after the census. And so that we have you can draw the election districts more or less in line with demographics. And under DeLay's leadership, the legislature in Texas did it mid-decade because they saw enough. They wanted to make sure that they did not lose the House in the 2004 election, and has been so they drew up a really, really gerrymandered, really partisan map that would give them extra seats to ensure that they wouldn't lose the House in 2004. Now, again, all parties have been gerrymandering in the United States for centuries, but the norm that these guys violated was they didn't wait to the end of the decade. They did it mid-decade. They saw a moment where they really needed it in the middle of the decade, and they did it.
Yeah, voter ID laws is another example of constitutional hardball. And this, of course, in the United States, the determination of who has the right to vote really falls to the states to implement this and, you know, Protection of Voting Rights Act and so on. And it's up to the states. And so what one has seen over the last 15 years is really the myth propagated that there's rampant voter fraud in the United States. And, you know, according to all social scientific evidence, you know, it's really basically non-existent. Nonetheless, what's happened, and I think 15 Republican-led states over the last 20 years or so have been Republican state legislatures trying to implement voter ID laws to using neutral sounding language of cleaning up the elections. In fact, really limiting the right to vote for voters disproportionately, it affects voters who would tend to vote Democratic. So it's really a strategy of restricting the right to vote, that or at least reducing access to the polls of people who might vote for Democrats. And so this is a way of trying to entrench oneself in power and insulate one's a party in power from being voted out of power. And so this is another example. And this is an ongoing debate, of course, in states today. And in Indiana, for instance, there was an effort to change voting rules in one particular county that tended to vote more Democratic. And so this is rampant and is a sign of playing with our institutions in a very dangerous way.
in some of these states, in Texas comes to mind, you call them people. Yeah, they're people, all right, but oftentimes what they're really doing is aiming at African-Americans, Latinos, and other minorities, aren't they?
Yeah, it has a partisan end. I mean, there's clearly a racial component, but there's a reason why that voter ID laws have been pushed exclusively by Republican state legislatures. The voter ID laws clearly make it harder to vote for lower income, usually first or second generation immigrants, and often minority voters. Those are those for whom it's often more difficult to come up with the paperwork with the identification necessary to register and to vote. And so any set of rules or regulations that make it more difficult for lower income and minority voters to vote are going to make it more difficult for Democratic Party voters to vote. And Republicans obviously know that. So there is a partisan objective here. It's very clear, and Republicans admit this in private, it's very clear this is not about combating election fraud. There's no serious election fraud in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is about reducing turnout of Democratic Party voters in order to win elections.
One of the things that we report in our book is looking back historically, and this is the benefit, I think, of having a broader historical perspective on this, that after the end of Reconstruction, the institutionalization of Jim Crow in the South involved introduction of a whole new set of voting rules that often using very neutral sounding rules that didn't sound like they were targeting particular groups were really designed to limit the right to vote for African Americans in the U.S. South. And so you had, beginning in the 1890s, and we have a whole section on this describing how this was implemented state by state with, again, very neutral sounding rules to restrict the right to vote to help the Southern Democrats at that point to entrench themselves in power. And so what you see is a huge drop off in black voter turnout in the South, beginning in the 1890s, all the way up through the 1960s, and single-party rule in the U.S. South supporting the Democrats, the Southern Democrats. And so this is something we've seen before, and I think having this historical perspective allows us to see that this kind of thing is possible again in the United States today.
So one of the things students in American Government 101 learn is that political parties aren't in the Constitution. They came along a little bit later, and you guys talk about that. You call those the gatekeepers. Help us understand how they're the gatekeepers, and more importantly, show us how the ideological big tent parties of yesterday have now gravitated toward two very different kinds of parties based on race and religion and geography, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's fascinating. Again, this is one of these points that the Constitution, you know, doesn't contain a lot of things that we often think that it does. And so, you know, political parties really basically hadn't been invented yet, as hard as it is to believe when our Constitution was written. They emerged slowly, really beginning only in the 1790s into the first part. And, you know, the founders really didn't particularly like parties. I mean, it was a sort of category of organization they didn't want in our society. But as political parties emerged, they really serve two functions. I mean, sometimes think about, you know, they certainly serve a representative function in the sense that they are supposed to represent what voters want. But political parties serve another function, which is they serve this gatekeeping function. And by that, what we mean is that parties have come to serve the role of picking our candidates. So before a general election, and whether presidential elections or congressional elections, we have to know who is it that's going to be on the ballot. And political parties select the candidates. It's kind of an invisible part of our democracy. They select the candidates. Historically, up until 1972, in fact, the way that this worked was that political parties, they got together in various forms, conventions or whatever, where party leaders got together in what's often called smoke-filled back rooms. Party leaders got together. They knew the potential candidates. They saw them up close. They had seen them in moments of crisis, seen them in moments of triumph. They knew which of them might be demagogues, and they chose candidates they thought could win. But very often what they did in the end was pick candidates who were not demagogues. And so although there were lots of people throughout American history who, you know, were potential demagogic leaders, I mean, we kind of recount the story of Huey Long or Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Motor Company, wanted to be a candidate for office, he would have never made it through this gatekeeping. If the smoke-filled back rooms, the party leaders never would have selected him. Beginning in the 1970s, we had, rightfully, I think, a reform of the system. I mean, the system was not very democratic, not very inclusive. It was all white men, essentially, most of the time, picking our candidates. So the system was opened up, and the system of primaries were introduced, were binding primaries. I mean, there had been some primaries in some states, but they were not binding. Now you had a system where voters could select the candidates in the system that we all know now, primaries and caucuses. And it's a long primary and caucus season where voters have a say, more of a say. And so voters now pick our candidates. And so the gatekeeping system certainly is more inclusive now. It's much more open. It's much more, it's probably more democratic in some sense of that. But the downside of it, and political scientists warned at the time of the reform in the 1970s, that it also opened the gate potentially for demagogues. And someday it might make it easier for a demagogue to make it through. And that's really what we began to see in the 2016 election. Just one final note on the gatekeeping is that, you know, beginning in the early 1980s, the Democratic Party saw this system, and there were some reformers who introduced a system where party leaders also had a say in addition to the primaries. This is a system that's been described as a system of superdelegates, where congressional leaders, governors, local party notables have a supplementary say to the voters in helping pick the candidates. The Republicans never introduced a system of superdelegates. And so in many ways, the door was much more wide open for Donald Trump when he decided to run. And it was much harder to keep somebody like this out. So that's sort of the system of gatekeeping. But maybe Steve can say a word about how the system has become so polarized over time, where you have the parties have become, rather than big tent parties, this is the second part of the question, how big parties have become kind of very distinct parties over time.
Right. Please, Steve.
Sure. If you go back 50 years, the Democratic and Republican parties differed on a bunch of things. They differed about foreign policy, about government spending, taxes. But they were culturally and demographically pretty similar. They were both predominantly white Christian parties. We tend to forget this, but it wasn't that long ago that evangelical Christians were slightly more Democratic than they were Republican. And three things have changed very quickly over the last 50 years, three really fundamental things. One, with the civil rights movement and with the civil rights laws of the 1960s, that triggered a massive migration of Southern whites from the Democrat to the Republican Party. At the same time, African Americans, some of whom were just getting the right to vote for the first time, flocked to the Democratic Party, who were seen as responsible for civil rights. Second thing is, beginning in the 60s, we experienced a large-scale wave of immigration, first from Latin America, more recently from Asia. Those immigrants and their kids have been largely Democrat. Third, there has been, since Reagan, a massive migration of evangelical Christians to the Republican Party. So you add those three things up, and you now have two parties that are culturally and demographically very distinct. The Democrats are still a very big tent party. They're really kind of a very heterogeneous mix of urban, educated, secular folks, urban white liberals, and a variety of ethnic minorities. Whereas the Republican Party is much more homogeneous. It is a predominantly still white and Christian party. Why does that matter? It matters in our view because white Christians are not just any group. White Christians used to be an overwhelming majority in this country, and they used to sit on top of just about every hierarchy that we have, whether it's the sitting in the presidency, Congress, governor's mansion, Supreme Court, CEOs of major companies, pillars of local communities, TV telecasters, college professors, you name it, the face of the Democratic and Republican Party. That has changed. That has changed dramatically over the last 30 or 40 years. And the loss of social status, the loss of a dominant social status, can be a really threatening thing. And we think that is ultimately what's fueling polarization in this country. It's very difficult. If you look across the world, it's very difficult for ethnic majorities to lose their dominant status without a pretty good fight.
So the question becomes, how do we bring people together again? And you, at the conclusion of your book, Daniel and Steve, come up with three likely roads leading out of this problem we are now confronted with. Would you run through those three roads quickly, landing on the third? And then I'd like you to talk a little bit in conclusion about what some of the Democratic politicians are saying out there today, which is Dems need to fight like Republicans fight. That's the problem. Dems haven't really learned how to play this game. And you guys are challenging those Democrats on that one. And I'll have you explain that.
Okay, we'll take those in turn. The three scenarios we see is one, that Trump leaves office soon. Either he is impeached or he just loses the 2020 election and things kind of go back to normal, that there's a recognition among both parties that there was a lot of sort of abusive behavior. Maybe the way that we did after Nixon and Watergate, pass some new reforms to clean up government a little bit. And so there's no real long-term damage done. We look back on history, and this looks like kind of a blip. That's one scenario. That could happen. That's the most optimistic scenario in terms of our democracy. The most pessimistic scenario is one in which the Republicans win the next few elections and are able to really entrench what is essentially minority rule via a combination of controlling the courts and the Senate and successfully implementing voter ID laws and perhaps using restrictive immigration policies to really limit the electoral base of the Democratic Party. We don't think that is a particularly likely outcome, but that's sort of the disaster scenario from the standpoint of democracy. What we think is the most likely outcome is something that looks a little bit like the state of North Carolina, which is sort of sliding in and out of institutional crisis as both sides play constitutional hardball. So we were just talking to some senators, and one of the senators told us that he thinks that never again will we be in a place where the presidency is held by one party and the opposition party controls the Senate and the president can nominate a Supreme Court justice. He doesn't think that any president without a majority in the Senate will ever again be able to get a justice through the Senate. That's a high level of dysfunctionality. So the third scenario is that continued polarization and a continued escalation of constitutional hardball doesn't lead to the collapse of democracy, but it leads to an increasingly dysfunctional democracy and one that sort of slides in and out of crisis as we have over the last few years. So that's the three scenarios.
And I guess the point is then what can be done to avoid the worst two scenarios? In our conclusion, we elaborate both, what Republicans can do, but we also, to answer your question, what about Democrats? What can Democrats do? And one of the things that we think is interesting is there is a lot of debate in progressive circles now, and this idea, as you put it, that Democrats need to learn to fight like Republicans. And if Democrats, in fact, don't do that, that they'll continue to be, it's a kind of form of unilateral disarmament, where one side seems to break the rules and break the norms, the Republicans, and the Democrats continue to abide by the rules and keep getting beaten. And so, the idea is, well, they need to fight back. They need, maybe Democrats the next time, let's say the Democrats retake the Senate and Trump gets another nominee for the Supreme Court, which, is a very plausible scenario. Maybe Democrats should do to Republicans what Republicans did to President Obama, which is not even hold hearings and prevent the president from even being able to appoint a justice whatsoever to the Supreme Court. Or maybe if the Democrats, other people have said, if the Democrats retake the Senate and the White House, that they should pack the Supreme Court. They should expand the size of the court because it's not in the Constitution, once again, not specified how big the Supreme Court is. Maybe they should load up the Supreme Court with a bunch of liberal justices to tilt things in the direction of the Democrats. Now, I understand that's very, if you're a Democrat, this all sounds very, tempting. But our basic point is that if Democrats begin to behave in this way, what one will have, if one looks around the world, is when both sides have played this kind of game of constitutional hardball, one has an escalation of politics where you get a kind of spiral where both sides are escalating and it doesn't end well. You get more and more unstable politics, and that Democrats really need to behave, continue to fight hard on policy. They need to disagree with Republicans where they disagree. But when it comes to our basic institutions, it's a different matter. They need, they can be very left-wing on policy, but when it comes to institutions, they need to, in order to get through the kind of current crisis of democracy that we're in, we need to have our institutions intact. And if we don't do that, at the end of this process, we may end up in a situation where we don't even have our basic institutions. And so Democrats have a real responsibility, and, certainly that Republicans need to come around as well, but we think this has to come through our electoral institutions. We really think that a necessary condition for Republicans to reform themselves is a series of major electoral defeats where they're convinced that the strategy they're using no longer works. And the Republican Party itself needs to transform itself and become a much more diverse party. This is absolutely necessary as well. But the responsibility of the Democrats to get to the medium and long term where things might look better is to continue to abide by the basic norms that make our democracy stable.
Gentlemen, we've run out of time. 28 years I've taught political science. 18 years I served as an elected official, both as a Republican legislator and a statewide official, and 15 years as a university president, I've read a lot of this stuff. I have never read an account of the state of our nation's politics that is more accurate, more honest, more historical than what you guys have done here in this book, How Democracies Die. We don't have a book of the year at Reader's Corner, but if we did, this would be it. I urge our listeners, let's learn from it. How Democracies Die. Our authors are Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Next week, retired baseball pitcher Jim Abbott talks with us about his book, Imperfect, An Improbable Life. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.